So in your new book, one of the things that readers of your first book, Trampoline, will notice is that you have a new narrator, Weed Eater. He cuts lawns and does other odd jobs. And in this book, we switch between Don Jewell, the character of your first book, and Weed Eater's point of view. So why'd you decide to bring in a new character for this one?
I'm not really sure why I put him in there, to tell you the truth, but he just ended up in there. It was based on somebody I knew and was clear and that I liked. I don't know why. It was just a clear person. It was funny. I knew how to draw him. I usually don't know exactly how to draw them over and over, but he was visually very clear. I was kind of interested in a character who was a little more on the side and also kind of was all about heart and not about understanding exactly what was going on, but was willing to kind of make sense of the world without always having a clear handle on what was going on. You know, I thought that was kind of interesting. I was also interested in a potentially threatening male character who was actually trying to be a decent person. You know, I thought that would be an interesting kind of counter stereotype.
And I don't want to give too much away, but his character plays some pivotal roles in the plot and the movement of what happens in this book. It's almost as if he's there to play these like crucial roles in what happens to a lot of the characters.
Yeah, he's a man of action, that's for sure.
And you mentioned illustrations and drawings, and I should say that like Trampoline, this is an illustrated novel. About every page has a cartoon that you've drawn, and usually it's Don's point of view or Weed Eater's point of view, something in their head that they don't say out loud, kind of like to get the internal monologue out there. And I really love this one picture you have early on in the book. It's of Don saying, "I don't think any of us would know what straightened out would look like." What does she mean by that?
I think that, you know, they're in such a mess, and it's both localized and the product of where we are as a country and just the way of the world, that I was thinking about this on the way into work, about maybe writing a scene. I saw somebody had a Trump flag that said "Make America Great Again," and I'm always on the tip of whenever I see somebody saying that or with that saying, exactly, you know, can you put a year on that? What's the date of that greatness that we don't have now but once had? Because, you know, I don't think that a lot of Americans would consider it that great a time. So I'm always kind of interested in the specificity of that particular part of Trump's approach. And so I think Dawn is kind of speaking to that, right? It's like she's just not sure when the good old days were, when things were on the right track.
And for those that haven't read Weed Eater, this book is the sequel to your first book, Trampoline. And a few years have passed. And in that first book, Don was still a teenager. The opioid epidemic was just kind of starting to emerge. Maybe, I think you said it was like around 1999 or 2000 where you're imagining that first book took place. And now, you know, fast forward a few years, you can really see in the second book, the opioid epidemic has caused widespread havoc on her community, on her family. Talk a little bit about what's happened to Dawn in the past few years between the first and second book.
You know, Dawn has kind of drifted into marriage and motherhood, and she's not quite convinced it's either one is for her. You know, if the first book is about how she's trying to find herself buffeted between two strong females, each of which has their own things on their mind that aren't her. In the first book, it's her mother who's got substance abuse issues and her grandmother who's an environmental activist. In this book, she's much more kind of on her own and has the independence that maybe she thought she needed in the first book. And it's very complicated to be kind of out there figuring it out by yourself. And, you know, like many people, she's kind of got a family and she's not sure she was ready for it. And so she's navigating through all that and still having to take care of her mother.
Yeah, in this book, we kind of see that as much as she tries to get away from the problems back home in Kentucky and her mother's problems, they kind of pull her back into their chaos. And we see that in this one scene where Dawn's mother and her mother's friends come over and kind of crash in on Dawn's home in Tennessee. Can you read a little bit from that scene?
Our trailer set in a quiet park with a creek run through it outside Kingsport. Willow trees stood waiting for kids to chase in and out amongst the whips of their branches. There were trees stout enough for tire swings and plenty of room between the trailers, like you wouldn't see nobody do now. Now everything is stacked tight, cracker boxes crammed on a shelf in a jammed-up dollar store. We walked in the trailer to Groundhog lying on his side, barely on the sofa, he was so huge, his shirt off and sweating, sucking his thumb, eyes opening and closing slow. The TV blared the bells and screams of a game show. Slobber ran down Groundhog's wrist. I said, "Get off my sofa, you nasty f***." And Mama said, "Where's the bathroom?" And I said, "Take her, Willet, watch her." And Mama said, "God almighty, Don." And I said to the couch, I said, "Get your fat s*** out of my house." And Groundhog just rolled over away from me. And I slapped both hands on his arm to drag him off. But he was so sweat slick, I lost hold. I gouged my fingernails into him and I rolled him off onto the carpet. Shook the whole trailer when he hit. And Fu Manchu, he laughed from my kitchen. Everything in the refrigerator was out on the counter. Mustard splattered like paintball on the floor. Bread stacked up outside the bag, 7 slices high. I said, "God almighty." So as not to cry, I started kicking Groundhog. And Fu Manchu laughed and shoved his mouth full of potato chips. And I started stomping Groundhog and said, "Get up!" And he curled up like a ball. I said, "Get him out of here," to Fu Manchu. And when he didn't do nothing, I said, "Don't bother me to call the law, get him up." And Fu Manchu said, "Evie let us in. She had a key." And I said, "What?" And Fu Manchu said, "We're invited guests." And I said, "I didn't give Evie no key." And Evie come up the hall and said, "Yeah, you did. You sure as hell did." And I said, "Get out of here before I blow the hell out of all of you." And Groundhog said, "I'd like you to blow the hell out of me." And I pulled a piece of old shire curtain rod out from under Willet's chair. And I reared back to bust Groundhog over the head with it. And Fu Manchu come up behind me and snatched the rod from my hand. He shoved me over top of Groundhog. And I fell head first onto the sofa. And I turned to get up, but Fu Manchu shoved me back down. And Groundhog got up. And they stood over me, a stone wall of suck. And cool air come off Fu Manchu like an open icebox. He drew the shower curtain rod back like he's going to backhand me. And I started crying. And I wasn't scared of getting hit. I was grieving. Grieving for my lost house, my lost safe spot. I cried because my baby's private place, my quiet place, the peace place where me and Willet might be able to work things out was gone. You don't know, do you? You don't know what it's like to never want anything because you don't have a way to keep it safe. Every single thing in my life got broke or stole or lost. Every chair in pieces, every rug pissed on. Every glass and plate and toy and pretty little thing on every shelf shattered. You don't put your hand down in the cushion of your burn hole sofa because you'll come back with your finger cut on bottle glass or a needle or tin can lid. Blood beating like a Super Bowl because can't nobody give a shit. But our house hadn't been like that. It wasn't perfect like Willet's mother's, but it was ours. And it was nice because none of my family knew where I lived.
Why do you think it's important for us to read these kinds of books to really get inside someone's life? This is some real stuff that's happening. It's kind of dark and it's not a rosy life for Dawn. Why do you think it's important for people to kind of, I guess, empathize with what's going on for someone like Dawn?
I think people that don't live in constant crisis, you know, they deal with crisis as something that, you know, the day before you had a good night's sleep and you resolve the crisis and then, you know, your life is less crisis-filled the next day. I think that one of the things that helped me understand people's decision-making process here is that it's just perpetual crisis.
Do you think this is the book about somebody who's hopeless? Do you think there is hope for Dawn Jewel?
I think if she didn't have hope somewhere in her, she'd have been gone by the middle of the first book. You know, I think that her hope is in many ways, although it doesn't always get articulated, that it's there. You know, that in some ways she has the most irrational of hopes and the most kind of strong of senses of hope, that she's just kind of soldiering on. And I think the thing is that, you know, that in the end they can't hope alone. You got to have somebody to hope with. Somebody's got to reinforce that hope. And so I think that's all operative in the books, you know, that they're kind of meditations on this American idea of, you know, the individual hero that can handle everything. And then the more realistic idea that, you know, we have to have a team. We have to have a support community. I think to answer your question that she must have hope, or she'd have already been incinerated by this life of hers.
And I don't want to give away too much of what happens in this book, but it's not all bleak. And there's another scene which I love. It's the scene where everybody goes to Dollywood, and you get this sense that for just a few hours or part of a day, everybody in the book suspends all the problems and tension that they've got going on in their lives. Can you read a little bit from that section?
Dollywood is a big deal. I mean, it's a big deal everywhere, but it's a big deal where we live here. There are all kinds of stories about coal miners coming home, putting their spare change in a jar, and then when summertime comes around, you take that money, and that's your Dollywood money, and people going in groups, and coal companies, you know, giving away tickets to all their workers. And so it's difficult to underestimate the importance of Dollywood in the community. So in Weed Eater, Hubert, as is his lifestyle, ends up with a bunch of money that he has to get rid of. He needs to get shed of it. And so he decides to take everybody that wants to go in Kennard County to Dollywood. And so, of course, the day gets sullied for Dawn, but there is a moment of happiness. And here's some of that. When we finally got to Dollywood, people were pouring across the parking lot, kids excited, old people on the shuttle buses smiling and pressing their teeth back in place. When we got to where you go through the gate, there were groups from other places dumping out of their tour buses, all wearing the same color T-shirts, listening to people tell them when and where they needed to be back. The Kennard people all went terrassing up to the gate, where Hubert stood with a fistful of tickets, thick as a brick, handing them out to everybody who stuck their hand out for one. And soon as we got in, Willett started telling me stories on all the Dolly Parton songs playing over the loudspeakers. At the museum, we saw the rag coat Dolly had when she was little, her coat of many colors. And we saw her report cards, and all that kind of went over Nicolette's head, but she loved the birds, the big bald eagle, Sanctuary. And while we were standing there looking at the eagles, Decent come up eating a turkey leg and told us how her sister got proposed to right on the spot where we were standing. And then June told us about a girl she knew in school who got proposed to on the Ferris wheel in the carnival part of Dollywood.
So it's like this almost hyper-real, I don't know, scene where everything is glorious for a few hours. I love it.
It's easy to write books about hard places and for them just to be very gray and not have a place in them for, you know, those vivid, happy, colorful moments. And I think, but you know, one of the things that in terms of living in this world is that the ability to savor, you know, to enter into fully the happiness of something good happening is pretty well developed in people. And it's a part of it. You know, that's a part of surviving.
I won't ask you to give away what's in your third book, but I have this feeling there might be another narrator in store for us in that third book.
Yeah, well, people can probably figure out where it's going if they read the second book, but it's set like in 2016, 2017. The time of the year is the Hillbilly National Holiday, which is Halloween, so it's a Halloween book. And yeah, it's funny, a lot of them are starting to talk. Don's daughter's starting to talk, Hubert's starting to talk. I've been hearing from him a lot here lately. It's more complicated. What I'm working on right now is there is a murder, there is a body, and they're trying to get rid of it. At the same time, they're turning some of their houses into Airbnbs. They've got travel writers coming, and they still have mayhem to cover up, and you know, so that's kind of the launch point for it.
Well, Robert, your second book was definitely well worth the wait, and I look forward to your third in maybe a couple of years. Always great talking with you.
Yeah, same to you, Roxy. Thanks for having me on.